themselves and tell you a little bit about what they do at our institution. As a public services archivist, I am responsible for instruction as well as reference and outreach that also includes programming.
Hello everyone, my name is Andrea Burns. I am a library technical assistant in the e-learning technologies unit.
Hi, I'm Sarah Tanner, and I'm the head of the Archives Research Center at the AUC.
Hi, I'm Justin Dela Cruz. I work in e-learning technology as well with Andrea, so we work on faculty outreach and technology training for students.
Okay, so as I said, today we'll be discussing ways the Atlanta University Center of Woodruff Library has used the social media platform Snapchat to both engage students while documenting student life to then be preserved within our institution's archive. Before I start, I'd like to just ask a little bit why you all chose to attend our presentation.
Anyone? Anyone want to answer? It's being recorded, so you just think it's over.
I work at the Harvard Law Library, and in the past year, a couple of my colleagues, actually not myself, dedicated themselves to trying to establish better relationships with all the student groups. Prior to that, we had very little in our collection, and so I thought this is something they didn't think about, but I'm hoping that maybe I can bring back some ideas for them.
And I'm a university archivist, and student life is really hard to document, so I'm always interested to hear how to do it better in different ways.
Hi, Gabrielle Vail. I'm an anthropologist associated with UNC Chapel Hill. We recently did a project with Maya Youth connecting from North Carolina and Yucatan. And we've done some other projects in Yucatan using photo voice and methods like that. But I'm really interested because I know the students sort of had their own way of documenting this experience that we didn't have, and I'm really interested in tapping into that.
Right. I hope that you all will find this informative as well as inspiring. And we'll go ahead and continue. We will showcase the practical approaches for documenting contemporary material from the emerging social media platform Snapchat and the technological aspects for digitally preserving these materials. We'll also hope to give you some ideas for creative ways to engage user-driven content for the purpose of preserving the archival record. We will explore the ethical limitations and concerns when documenting user-created content of the private sphere and the public record. And lastly, we will hope that we show how improving representation of underdocumented groups within the archival record, and in this case, college students, is very important. Our first, this is just a basic overview of the presentation and what we will talk about. I'll first start with the basic historical context and discussion about the Atlanta University Center Woodruff Library, the institutions we serve, and the overall objective and goal for our projects. You will then hear my colleagues talk about more about the social media platform Snapchat, the execution of the project, as well as suggestions for how this project may be recreated for other institutions. And lastly, how we preserve and, in theory, would provide access to these records. So I'll talk about the idea, where it stemmed from. Andrea will go over what is Snapchat. Justin will then talk about the Snapchat trials that we did for the school year of fall 2017 through spring 2018. Sarah will discuss preservation and ethical concerns, and together we will kind of go over the challenges and reflections. In between each step, we will also have a small pair and share moment. There's not a lot of people in here, so you guys can just kind of talk amongst each other for a quick 2 minutes to discuss some of the questions that we will pose afterward, but we will ask for all the questions to be discussed at the end. However, whatever you come up with in your discussion, we do ask for you to comment on in those moments. So first, a little bit about the Atlanta University Center. The Atlanta University Center is the largest consortium of historically black colleges and universities. While all the schools that comprise the Atlanta University Center were founded right after the Civil War in the It was not until 1929, under the direction of Dr. John Hope, who had the idea to create these feeder schools. So Atlanta University would cease its undergraduate degrees and solely focus on graduate education for African Americans. Morehouse College would educate African American men, Spelman African American women, and the idea was that they would just matriculate into one another. Throughout its 90-some-odd-year history, the AUC has changed in many ways in transition, some of which include the physical incorporation of Clark University and Morris Brown College to the physical space of what we know as the Atlanta University Center, and that was in the 1940s. There were two other HBCUs that were close in proximity, but again, like I said, in the 1940s, they moved physically to the space that we know as the Atlanta University Center today. In 1958, you had the creation of the Interdenominational Theological Center, which was comprised of all the seminaries that were a part of these other institutions. And then in 1988, you had the consolidation of Clark University and Atlanta University to create Clark Atlanta University. This is important because the Atlanta University Center, which is a library, serves all of these institutions. We are a separate nonprofit entity and don't actually belong to anyone, but we are all together and it serves as an academic hub for these institutions. We currently serve four institutions of the Atlanta University Center, and that includes Clark Atlanta University, the Interdenominational Theological Center, Morehouse College, and Spelman College. So as you can imagine, all the different resources that we have that relate to the different minors, majors, personal interests of the faculty, staff, and students can vary, and we have to support all of these institutions and these. So this project came about from just going about my normal day-to-day. While I am a millennial, I do not consider myself addicted to social media in any way, but I do, for the most part, try to keep up with the current trends of interacting with friends. And this led me to about 4 years ago to begin using the mobile app Snapchat. For those of you who are unfamiliar with Snapchat, it is a mobile social media app that allows individuals to share 10-second multimedia messages called snaps. You share these snaps with one another, and the difference in this social media platform, however, is that these messages disappear instantly or within 24 hours after its creation. Individuals are able to send snaps either personally or create a personal collection of these snaps that will appear as a story. So as with all social media platforms, the app is constantly changing and updating the user's experience. On one of the first 8 updates was the creation of the concept of our story. And according to Snapchat, our story is a place where Snapchatters can build big community narratives together. And these messages, or snaps as they are called, can be submitted and based on geographic makers. They show up in a search and they're grouped together with other snaps from the same location, event, or about the same topic. So an example of this was the HBCU Snap Story. So this story was geographically set at HBCU locations and are compiled by Snapchat and curated into unique first-person accounts of everyday life on the campus of the nation's HBCUs. Often this is accompanied by a set of questions and or a topic for discussion. These stories sought to out individuals in these geographic locations to share their thoughts. Some examples include the 2016 Hampton University became the first historically black university to field a men's lacrosse team in 35 years. And during their opening game, snaps flooded in from both Hampton and other HBCUs with people speaking about their excitement, overall well wishes, and school pride. And of course, after the 2016 presidential election, you had again the HBCU snap story was flooded by students about their take on the election results. On the screen, I have a screenshot of some of these conversations and news flashes that appeared in the HBCU Snap Story, some of which include, over here to the far right, we have Bradley State University. In the days leading up to their homecoming game, there was a fatal shooting on the campus. And so you had students kind of just talking about the effect that that shooting had on the campus, those who were mourning the actual student who lost their life, as well as just overall what it meant to happen during homecoming, such a fun and exciting time for students. These snap stories also reveal a lot about everyday student life on campus. So as you can see over here, You have something just kind of detailing just their everyday wear, what they wore to school and what they were proud to be wearing to school. So it just kind of gives you a glimpse into the everyday life of students that you often do not see. And so this was really eye-opening to me. In these moments also, I got to realize my personal connection to this. And that was, as an HBCU grad myself, some of my fondest memories were in the cafeteria, and specifically on Wednesdays, which at my school were called Fried Chicken Wednesdays. So fast forward to my job now working at an HBCU, I found out apparently a lot of HBCUs have the same day of Fried Chicken Wednesdays. And often you'll find multiple posts at these institutions documenting what seems to be this cafeteria ritual. So also while with all these universities, homecoming is also another big, huge week-long affair. And so the clip I'm about to show you now is actually from Spelman College, taking place again in the cafeteria, so this meeting and congregation space. And it's the Friday before homecoming. Exhibit of students on campus. What is your organization doing to capture this content?
So if you could talk amongst yourselves for a couple minutes, if anybody wants to share.
That she's gonna go ahead and click her link and see what's
happening. That was the one.
The collection that we have is AUC Hip Hop stuff. Do you know what I mean?
I feel like it's AUC Hip Hop Revolution.
Oh, okay. For some reason. Yeah.
Revolution. Right. Now, right. Now I'm scared.
But wouldn't that be like, but interpreted on the
front? It is life of me. I cannot remember this earlier today. Maybe it is. Does anybody want to share?
Dr. Bale said that in Mexico, the students were using Facebook still. So that actually worked for her documentation.
From other social media platforms is when you post something after 24 hours or after it's viewed, it's no longer there. And they said that people tend to use it because it disappears. And when compared to other platforms, they compare it to the Art Gallery versus Sandcastle comparison. And this is an example that Kevin Systrom, who is the CEO of Instagram, used. And he says that his users were using Instagram as well as Snapchat, because when they thought of Instagram, they thought of it more so as an art gallery. So these are images that represent me that will be up for a long period of time. And I don't know about you, what you're doing when you're 18, but some of those things you may not want to still be available when you're 34 or later on. So Snapchat allows you to kind of capture these moments and it goes away, as opposed to when you post on Instagram, unless you delete it, it's just kind of there lingering. So whoever looks up your page or whoever adds you on Facebook, they kind of can catch up to the history of your life. But they looked at Snapchat more so as a sandcastle. So you can have this moment, you can have this sporadic moment, and it can be very beautiful, but after a while it disappears. So it gives you the freedom to be silly and to have just like a random moment and be yourself, because after a while it just goes away. So you get more so of a truthful view into people's life, and that may be why 85% of its users are between the ages of 18 and 34. So when they describe their purpose, they mainly say that they want to empower users to, one, express themselves, two, live in the moment,
3, learn about the world, and 4, have fun together. So I'm going to go through each step and kind of show you what they do to kind of encourage these 4 behaviors. So the first is to express yourself. So any Snapchat users, first of all, anyone familiar with that? Okay, great. So you'll know that. You'll know what I'm referring to. So the main thing is expression. So they give you personalized experiences. They allow you to kind of create your own, bring your own creativity into what you're posting with filters, tags, lenses, captions, and stickers. So for example, when Tiffany showed the video of the Spelman students in the cafeteria, you saw the caption, which was that student's perspective on that moment. So that allows you to do that by adding captions and stickers and tags. And then also, like I said before, the ephemeral nature of the posts. Unlike Instagram and Facebook, they're only accessible for a limited time. So I use this example of Zendaya posting on Snapchat as opposed to her posting on Instagram. So both of them are somewhat of a candid shot, but one seems very much so intentional. So if you look at the post of her on Instagram, it's like her walking the street looking flawless and flawlessly dressed, surrounded by security. It's just like a candid moment. But when you look at what she posted on Snapchat, her caption is pearly whites. So it's mainly her talking about her teeth and how she thinks her teeth are pearly white. And she's added her own filter, so she can post a random moment and make a silly face because it'll be gone. So we see more so, I say in my opinion, you see more so of her personality. So if we can do this for our students to kind of really see those random kind of sporadic moments in their life, you tend to be able to capture a more unique perspective and more truthful perspective. The next is global connection and learning about the world. So the moment you make a Snapchat account, you are now considered a Snapchatter. You snap, and that's what it's called when you capture your video or pictures that you add to either your story or to others. And then you have lenses and geofilters, which allow you to, depending on your geolocation, you can add to a community story or lenses to be able to add to a particular aspect. So, the other way we have global connection is by using SnapMap. And I'd like to add this disclaimer now. I have no idea what's going to pop up because this is real time. and so what they have is this is called the SnapMap, and it allows you to see based on your geolocation what's going on around you. So it's a heat map. So depending on if there's a community or a particular location where people are snapping more frequently and contributing, you'll see the map kind of heat up. So it seems like there's things going on in this area, so we're going to click on it. I don't know what it would come up, but we'll see. Oh, good. Okay, so first go to New Orleans Aquarium, and you can just kind of see this is from random people through their perspective. We'll go for a few more. New Orleans riding in the car. I think this is a few blocks over. Oh, this guy. Okay, I'm guilty of a few of these. Let's see. Come shop bossy and it boss bags. Yeah. Okay, a little promotion. So I believe that's earlier outside of on the corner there in Bourbon, so that was a little bit earlier today. So mainly you can kind of see what's going on around you, but if you zoom out, you are able to see a broader view of what's going on in the world. So if someone shout out a location that you may be interested to know what's going on today or at the moment.
Bangladesh.
Thank you. allows you to kind of take a peek into this their real life and what's really going on in these particular areas. And also if anything is going on politically, you're able to capture that as well. So it's hard to see here if something's featured. Or throughout the day. So it's mainly content that's been curated, either featured by the editors or something that's been curated based on the frequency of snaps in those areas. So as you'll see, a lot of the major cities tend to be more of the hotter areas.
And to also give you all some context, when we were practicing before we came here, there was a protest going on in New Orleans. And so in that moment, you saw the protest, and it's from these multiple perspectives, but everyone who's still at this same event. So that's just how, again, seeing how the world reacts, and as far as when there's a large amount of snaps happening in one place.
And I know there was also like an accident that had occurred, and then you saw different people capturing that as well. So that was also featured. So that's really how they kind of connect internationally, and you're able to learn about the world. The next is just have fun together with stories. So as Tiffany mentioned, there are stories as a series of snaps contributed by one or more users with a common theme or geolocation, and that's mainly what you saw on the map. So when you have my story, that's your individual story of what you're capturing, but our story is a collection of stories as well as custom stories. That's a collection of stories as well. So our stories are created by story editors and producers. They determine the themes, the location, holidays, and festivals. They're produced by Snapchat. For example, the HBCU story was created by Snapchat, and they place it for geolocations. Also, community story editors review and they moderate snaps according to a particular guideline, and then they edit and publish them for local communities. So if you go back to the map and you see anything that says featured, you'll also notice that there are certain amount of editing where they'll maybe blur out sensitive content, or they'll add a lower third, or it's basically edited. But custom stories are created by users. So you name your story, you select who can contribute and who may view, and normally it's limited to friends or friends of friends. And that's particularly what we did, but Justin will tell you more about that. So since we started this project, Snapchat has gone through a number of changes in their interface. So when they describe it as separating social from media. So a number of changes that they have created include, first, it initially opens up to your camera and main profile page, which is pretty normal. But the next thing they've done is they've aggregated stories and direct messages into the same page, and they're not in chronological order, but in the order of who you engage with the most. They have Snap Map as well as Discover, and Discover is a separate page where content that's curated by employees based on your viewing history and what they've learned about you and what they think you may be interested in. So since that update, about 1.2 million of Snapchat's users signed a petition in opposition of the changes, and they saw a significant drop in usage. So my parent-share discussion is, how can updates affect the students' usage of social media platforms? And what measures can your institution set in place to stay abreast of these updates if you choose to document student life using these platforms? So I guess we'll do the same 2 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
was more just like, okay, I mean, maybe, but certainly nothing that matches.
Yeah.
Volunteers who maybe want to answer our peer share questions, either one or both.
For one of the updates that we mentioned, that will come up their rights policies and how we can, as an institution, access the information that regularly changes. So if you're talking to websites API, to harvest the data. So you just have to have technical skills to keep up to date on that and be able to adapt to those changes. And on Twitter, I made a large one recently, about maybe a year ago or so.
And just a reminder, all these questions will kind of make sense toward the end that we're asking, and they'll all make total sense.
The idea being that social media, this platform changed within a matter of months. Okay. So is there a way that your institution is sort of has a technology watch? Like, is there anything that you all are doing to sort of monitor how quickly the technology is changing and maybe how quickly students are using that technology? So that was the idea was behind this question, too.
Okay, so next I'm going to talk about technically what we did for our project here and a little bit of the challenges involved and basically tell you how to set up a Snapchat. I know some of you already used it, but I won't spend too much time on this. It is basically just like signing up for an email address. You just pick a username and put in a password. We did figure out that it's good to use a shared email, like an institutional email. That's generic, so if somebody leaves and it's tied to their email account, that you don't lose that login. One thing that makes Snapchat unique that we mentioned is that you have to connect with the friends base first. So on Instagram and Facebook, you can sign up and start making public posts, and they're discoverable, right? And they can go and search and look at those. But for Snapchat in particular, you have to reach out to friends and develop a network in order to share anything. You can post to some of these public stories, but you still have to have connections to friends to do direct messages or to basically make your own stories so people can see it. So one of the challenges is getting people to join up with your account. And so one of the things we did was during the heavy usage of the library, like in terms of finals, we'd walk around and tell them we had a Snapchat account, see if they wanted to connect, you know, in person, just walking up to them, posting signs, and mentioning it in classes and things like that when we're on campus. And then they'll also see that the library will have an account because we posted stories, so I'll talk about that next. But it is interesting to think about how do we connect users on this kind of platform that is kind of invisible. And then after you establish your friends group and your base to share with, you will post content and stories, and you can send them to individual students. So after I friended all these students, when we had an event coming up, I would just send them all a flyer for the event. You know, like, it's another way to market. So it's an interesting tool. Because they'll usually see that right away and they'll open it and look at it. We did a couple of, and then you watch content from your friends. And so now that I'm connected to student accounts, I can see what they're posting and what their friends are posting on stories and things like that. And as you have Snapchat, you can also go on campus and see what local stories there are. And so there might be ones around different themes, like events on campus or student groups. So I will show you some videos from projects, and then I'll talk about, you know, the nature of the videos and how we got them. And so our idea to start out was to do a pilot test with librarians. So some of us have used the platform, but we wanted to go through the full process of doing a Snap story, capturing the content, and seeing what it looked like afterwards. So we asked the librarians to do a custom story that was private, right? And so we had people join the library's account, and we did this story. And we we ask them to post randomly throughout their days sort of the unique things that they work on in the library. And these were librarians from different areas of the library. So tech services where the magic happens, humidification chamber, and it says stay tuned for draft ones. Circulation services. So you can see that you can post things on people's faces.
Can you turn it up, Sam?
Yeah. when librarians hear someone say nobody reads anymore, there's a picture of a fashion model looking upset. This is before and after of unrolling materials. Weird searches we do as librarians for faculty member, I swear. Curating maps of the library before and afters. That's our coding group. We're testing our Raspberry Pi. And so out of here, like, and so this is a group of, you know, public services and tech services librarians, basically showing off what they do. And it was a good test because it had multiple users and had them showing things from their perspective and adding some of the filters and things that you saw. So I'll talk about the process of downloading and capturing that material in a second. The second phase, the really fun part was launching a story during midterms. So at our library, we're open for 2 weeks for 24 hours. And so we posted a custom story that's geofenced around the library. So when you create a custom story, you can make it so that they have to be inside the library to post to that story. And they have to be a friend of the account or friends of friends of the account. So we had control over where they could post. And so the content was coming from inside the library. And it was coming during midterms when we're open 24 hours. And so this is what we got from that.
How do I turn it up, though?
Yeah. Cool. That's all right. Okay, that's the midterms. When they ask how college is going, it's been 5 seconds late.
I have to know 83 words by 1 o'clock today. I have a midterm on 83 words. Because how many of them I know?
Snapchat and we export it, and so I'm going to talk about that next, actually. Our idea for phase three was to have student groups generate their own stories and generate content of their own volition again, and we did try this with a movie event, and so this came after the change and update to Snapchat, right? So when we hosted a movie event in spring 2018, we hosted a custom story again, but just with that night. And when we had people arriving for the event, we told them about the Snap story, and I added a couple snaps myself. And 90 people showed up, and one person added to the Snap story besides me. So there is kind of a limiting factor there of sort of like, it's hard to force it, especially in that context of like, we have an event tonight, and we want to force the crowd to participate by adding stuff to Snapchat. That was a little harder, but one idea we had also was to make it more competitive and let them do it on their own time. So a Greek society competition of like who can make the best marketing video for their fraternity or sorority. We think that would be pretty cool, maybe for homecoming or something like that. And then give a prize away. That would be a great way to get content. The technical process is exporting, saving and exporting content. So they are, as a platform, stuff's supposed to disappear, right? But we do have custom stories that stay alive for longer than 24 hours. So if I post a custom story on a Monday and I post a snap to it, and somebody posts a snap to it on Tuesday, and somebody else posts a snap to it on Wednesday, this story will keep going and going until 24 hours passes and nobody adds to the story. So we did have it going for a little bit over a week during midterms until people just stopped adding to it because I think they were done with testing, and so it just kind of died off on its own. But you do want to, I was capturing the snaps on a daily basis because they will still disappear. So the first snap from Monday will not last through Wednesday. So the snaps will disappear over time. Still after 24 hours, it's just the story itself that stays alive. So every day at the end of my work day, I would just go in and save the snaps that had been submitted. And then we kind of stitch them together. Although you can curate and save the stories to your Snapchat memories, and you can export them from there. So that's basically what I was doing, saving some memories every time. Okay, so during the stories, when you play them back in the app, you have a lot of content that you can see, a lot of metadata. You can see when it was posted time-wise. You can see usernames and who's posting it, and that pops up in between each snap. And so that content is built in when you view it within the app. But one thing that happens is if you use it, the memories feature to save that story, and then you export it, it just comes as an MP4 video, and it doesn't put the timestamps in, and it doesn't put the user stamps in, so it cuts out all that metadata. So there is a way around it, and some of the videos you saw were a little bit lower content, kind of degrades audio, but you can actually have a screen recorder app, a third-party app, and you can record the screen when you're playing back within Snapchat, and so just kind of like a way around that feature, so you can still see the timestamps and you can still see the usernames. So we did that to capture some of the content, and we also exported it officially through Snapchat just to get that blank video. And these are statistics of what happens. Like I said, we posted the midterms at the library. We put up signs saying that we were on Snapchat, but we didn't really go out and tell people to add to it. This is more or less organically submitted material. And so we had 59 unique snaps, so pictures or videos, 59 individual ones, and 25 unique contributors. What was interesting to us is that only one of the contributors was actually a fan or a friend of the account to begin with. So we're opening it up to friends and friends of friends, and so visibility is kind of limited, and that might be why there weren't as many unique contributors, but only one of them was actually connected to the account, and the other ones were just on the periphery. Two of them were library staff, 22 were friends of friends. So we saw some themes in what they were contributing. You saw some humor in there. So the top contributors, one of them called himself Showtime Rand, did videos and series of videos. So if you hold down, you can do longer than 10 seconds on iPhone to take multiple snaps in one go. And so they did videos in humor and depictions of studying. And that was like 16 snaps by themselves. There was one account, Kells, that just did promotion, basically self-promotion. So if they're involved with an organization or trying to sell something or they have a business going, they would try and promote the materials. And then others would just capture random conversations of people studying, making jokes and cracking up, stuff like that, to release some of the tension from studying overnight for midterms in the library. So those themes, 24 snaps on studying, random humor were about 10, self-promotion 7, conversation 6. A couple of more risque posts. There was one about sexual activities. That was just words typing it out. And so that is something that Sarah's going to talk about with ethical concerns as part of that discussion. The time post for this, the interesting part was from 10 p.m. to 2 a.m. Was the most active period. And that was 27 snaps. And then from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., there were zero contributions to the story. over the course of this, like, 10 days. And so, mainly, they were taking tests or out eating lunch from 10 to 2. And then, in that sort of magic hour moment, they should be studying whatever, they're kind of adding snaps to it around midnight. And so, even from 2 to 6 a.m., there are a good deal of snaps, 17 of those. So the question here, and we'll talk about more about ethical concerns and other ideas behind this project and some of the stipulations from Snapchat and privacy matters and things like that next. But how could you encourage your users to generate or donate digital materials to you via platforms, social media platforms, otherwise? And maybe, do you have any ideas for us or for others here on how we can make that happen? Marketing outreach ideas, social media campaigns, generating a hashtag, making a competition. Is there something unique to your institution that would help us generate ideas for ours? So if we could think about that for a second.
I just feel like ours, the library social media isn't doing that. Like, we're documenting the library. You know,
yeah.
So how are you documenting student life with social media? It's something they're already using, which was the whole point of Snapchat, something they're already using. But
yeah,
it
so
changes so rapidly that it's like.
Figure out 519.
Hmm?
I said 519, you can share.
I have to turn the microphone on too because it's like low on battery.
Thank you, Selena. This has been really great. What we discussed in our room is, well, a couple of things. One was using it doing programming. We have programming in the library. We do program as far as like two programs that we have a year, and how we begin to get, you know, real live off the cuff reactions to our programming. Also, to get students to donate, it was discussed in our group, and you have his name tag on it. But using it as a promoting it as a digital yearbook. So like 10, 15 years from now, if you want to see what you did, what you look like, you'll be able to have that caption as well. Which made me think about, you know, when we have in our archives, we have diaries, we have letters. So to me, this is the same thing with this generation. So how do we get them to understand that these are your stories, just like a diary or letter, that you'll be able to have 10, 15 years from now. So selling it from that perspective, I think, would be really good.
The reason we initiated this project in the first place, and which in my mind was multifaceted, because we want to engage students with the library at large and with the archives and all of that as well.
but we also wanted to meet students where they are with the technology they were already using to capture, document, and preserve student life. We realized that students on campus were underrepresented in the archive, as Tiffany mentioned, and getting our students to consider collecting material and then donating it to the archive is an uphill battle. Even if they seem interested in it first, getting them actually over to the archive to bring me, even if it's digital material, all of that, it's sort of something that we're constantly thinking about because it's on our mind all the time, but it is not on their mind. But if we didn't do this work, were we going to have large gaps in our collections about student life, student activism on campus, the experiences of students at HBCU in 2017, 2018, all of that would almost entirely be lost unless we get buy-in from our students. So as archivists, we were concerned with preserving the digital content, and we are all, I think, profession-wide, been concerned with preserving digital content in all of its many forms. And we wanted to specifically take a look at a platform that was currently and actively being used by our students that had no inherent preservation capabilities. So this is different from Facebook and Twitter in that it doesn't have an API, and it's specifically meant to be ephemeral. So we had some success in doing this, but we wanted to think of an effortless way for students to create and donate materials in a real, authentic, and natural way. So student culture in the library during midterms, the concerns of students, how they're interacting with technology, all of that can be captured with Snapchat, but there are and were a few snags. So we're already using software like Archivit to capture the library's social media presence on platforms like Facebook. But Snapchat is not the only kind of platform with this sort of ephemeral idea. So there's also Instagram Stories. Facebook also has a similar function, and then live streaming that happens on both Facebook and Instagram. All of those are kind of similar in that there is no immediate way to capture all of that content just when you crawl the website. And when Tiffany first introduced the idea, my first thought was, well, does it have an API? Can we crawl it? If it doesn't, why are we even talking about it? It's just gonna be more work on us. But once again, if this is something that our students were using, it was definitely worth looking into. And if we were gonna tackle this beyond simply using it as an engagement tool, what were some of the ways that we could mitigate some of our concerns? So for the preservation of the file itself, Snapchat is created on an app on a phone. We've talked about that. And the presence, it doesn't have an API that you can crawl in the same way, so you have to download the content onto your personal phone, or maybe you want to consider having a library iPad or something like that to download it on so you're not getting it on your personal stuff too. And so this is a small but surmountable obstacle, like I said. You do lose some metadata when you download that, as an MP4 file. As Justin mentioned, you lose the timestamp, who contributed it, and all of that kind of stuff. But all of that metadata can be manually added back to it. So this is a decision-making process. How much time do you want to spend manually adding metadata to this file? How useful would it be? And so on and so forth. And then the preservation of the MP4 file itself is fairly straightforward. We ran it through our regular digital preservation workflow process. So once the file was preserved and downloaded, the real discussion began to get fuzzy when we started talking about ethics and access. So what exactly are we allowed to preserve and keep? What are the challenges we face beyond that physical preservation of the file? And just to be clear, we are talking about capturing the library's Snapchat account. We are not trying to capture individual Snapchat accounts. So we haven't marketed this as anything that we would do for students per se. But we want students to contribute content to the library Snapchat itself, if that's clear. So, to start with, I decided to go and read through the privacy policy of Snapchat to see what people were implicitly agreeing to and what we're all implicitly agreeing to when we decide to use Snapchat and what we're reasonably allowed to do with the content. And as a side note, and I think this was mentioned earlier, is that from the time when I read this to now, it very easily might have changed and changes as frequently as the updates do. So just because you've read through it once, and most people don't, and I don't normally, and you agree to something, it doesn't mean that those privacy policies remain the same. They change very rapidly. So even though users assume that the content is social and ephemeral, it doesn't mean that that is what you're agreeing to when you use the app. In fact, it is not what you're agreeing to when you use the app. And like I said, no one's actually sitting and reading through this, but it turns out you're agreeing to a lot of things when you decide to use the app. And the content you create is not as temporary as you think. Just to be clear, Snapchat is already collecting and possibly retaining almost every single thing you do in their app, from the type of phone you use, to the content you send, to how often you interact with specific users, the websites you visit before and after you go to Snapchat. And it even states explicitly in their privacy policy that it will do this, and it could potentially share your information with third parties. So, and I'm just gonna go through just, like, there's a few things on the slide just to give you an idea of the kinds of things you're agreeing to. They wrote it in this very readable way. It was almost like, we're so hip and cool, and write this in a way that everybody understands, but essentially, it's a free-for-all at the end of it. And it was like, basically it felt like it was saying everything is saying, trust no one. So, like I said, they're saving your username, your password, your email address, your phone number, your date of birth, and it's saying, it even says, so this is a direct quote, it says, keep in mind that the users you send snaps, chats, and other content to can always save that content or copy it outside the app. So the same common sense that applies to the internet at large applies to Snapchat as well. Don't send messages or share content that you wouldn't want someone to save or share. It seems kind of like a very broad statement they're just using to cover themselves, but the idea being that, yes, even though this stuff is ephemeral and you think it's gone in 24 hours, it's probably not. Anyone at any time can be saving it, sharing it, keeping it, and third parties are often doing that. And so that was just for me to get an idea of what we all were agreeing to when we decided to use the app. However, I don't consider that explicit permission for us to necessarily capture that content and preserve it. So now it says that that third parties may be doing it, it's fine, we can make it accessible to the world. I don't necessarily consider that to be that statement. I just felt like it was important for users to know what they were agreeing to when they decide to use Snapchat. So Snapchat itself is collecting and using the content. It tells users that other parties may be doing the same. And so even though I don't consider that to be clearing us of any sort of privacy concerns or ethical concerns for preserving the content, we decided that we would not provide access to the Snap, to the, even the library Snapchat account that we were preserving for now, and not probably even in the very near future we wouldn't provide access to it. So even though Snapchat allowed us to have both library and student-generated content on a platform that students were already using, the privacy and ethical concerns surrounding providing access to that content, including student videos, their voices, and all of that without their explicit consent, can be problematic. Even though they chose to voluntarily add that content to the library Snap Story, that doesn't mean that they realize we're preserving it for hopefully the next 1,000 years or so in an ideal world. So this led to my task to think of ways that we can provide access to the content. And like I said, as of really right now, we can't. So what does that mean for us? If we aren't providing access to it now, is it even worth us sort of pursuing this? And that's another question that we'll have later. But there may be a time when it is accessible, with limited access, perhaps in the reading room or something like that, and hopefully. And we're trying to make sure that we're collecting an accurate and complete record. So 50 years from now, when people come back and want to know what it was like, as researchers come in now and ask Tiffany all the time, about student life in the 60s on HBCU campus, we want to be able to provide that sort of information going forward, too. So I don't think it's fair for us to be like, this is kind of difficult in a gray area, so we should just ignore it. But it does. I think it bears having a discussion, and that's why we're doing this today. So Justin mentioned this, but we decided to have users generate content, which for the first go-around was successful, for the most part. And the entire premise of adding Snapchat to the social media platforms we preserve is because there is that inherent difference between Facebook and even Twitter. And we wanted content created from these students, but let's be honest, they are college students, And college students and even grown adults don't always use the best sense when it comes to social media, and we did receive inappropriate content. So solicitations, inappropriate language, students making fun of other people, and that sort of thing. So while this is not about censorship, it is about what we are allowed to have on the library Snapchat account representing sort of the library in that way. So this is under the RWWL Snapchat account. So when people go look at our story, these are the things that you could potentially see. So while the user-generated content was perfect, exactly what we wanted, we also realized that it does require curation. So that's just another consideration when you're thinking about how you want to engage with your users and how much staff time you can devote towards this. It did take Justin going every day at the end of the day and sort of curating the content, downloading the Snapchats, and that sort of thing too. So that's just a consideration to have. And like Andrea mentioned, most stories are curated anyway. And like I said, it's not about censorship. It's about just as a library, what administration wants us to have on something that is representing the library too. Just a challenge to keep in mind. So again, many students and younger people see this platform as purely social with less professional aspects. The snaps disappear, they aren't meant to be revisited. It gives it that carefree feel, but it also presents a problem when we ask them to join the library's account. Many were hesitant to do so because they saw this app as something they do with their friends, not something they do with their school or with their library or with the librarian. So when Justin went around and was asking students to join the library Snapchat, I think some of them might have been hesitant. So it's just another challenge to take to consider and think about. When we're asking students, and maybe if we can pitch it or come up with a good way to pitch our story, why we're doing this, why they should consider contributing and that sort of thing, maybe have that in the back of our minds when we're talking to our students, I think that would be worthwhile too. So these are some of the challenges we face. We do curate content. We spend time manually adding metadata. Are students going to consider adding the library to the library Snapchat when it's just for their friends, and what are we going to do with it? And while we're not necessarily providing a lot of hard, fast solutions to all of these questions, I think it was important for us to bring this forward. We did it, and I think it went well. I think even if it's not with Snapchat, that this is the way that our students are engaging with each other. And like I said, not even specifically Snapchat, but whatever new social media, which was that technology watch question. There will be new things, and they will be coming quickly. So what are we as librarians doing? And maybe as an older, we're not our students' age necessarily, how are we sort of keeping our ear to the ground? What are we doing to make sure that we are interacting and engaging with our students, and then considering how we might preserve it? And then one more challenge presented itself. Mid-project, as my colleague mentioned, Snapchat didn't update, and all of a sudden nobody was using it anymore. Not literally no one, but these social media apps change demographics quickly. And so even though investors are still pumping money into Snapchat, we realize that maybe students aren't necessarily even going to be using it long term. Which brings up another sort of really relevant question, and that is, if this app is changing so quickly and we're just sort of letting it go by and not considering preservation, not considering access or using it to engage our students, how much content are we then losing? What kind of voices could we potentially miss when we don't seriously consider the ways our students are communicating with each other and the way we're documenting student life? So like I said, these challenges, it seems like a daunting task with the constant technology changes, unclear legal risks, but I think if we don't come up with some solutions, even if they are temporary solutions, so we're capturing the content, we are preserving it, we're not providing access, but I still think it's worth doing because we run the risk of losing an entire generation's worth of data if we're not sort of paying attention to how our students are interacting. And then 50 years from now, when people come into the archive, there'll be very little record of our students' lives on campus. Which brings me to our last discussion question, and then we'll wrap this up. But given the challenges, ephemeral nature of Snapchat, and the privacy concerns, should Snapchat or other similar social media be considered for preservation when documenting student life? So is this even worth our time as archivists? And like I said, and as was mentioned earlier, students are not really using Facebook. And even though we're capturing Twitter and a lot of things are happening on Twitter and Instagram, should we stick to what we know and are comfortable with? Should we push ourselves to face these more difficult questions and engage with our students in unique ways, sort of meeting them where they are to get this user-generated content? So this is just a question, and you don't have to discuss amongst yourselves if you don't want to, you can just share. What do you guys think about taking on something that's a little bit more difficult? Is it worth doing? Should we be considering this as archivists, as cultural heritage preservers?
Does anybody want to go out and do it right now?
Well, I think you kind of alluded to it earlier that we have to do something because there will be a gap in the collection if you don't begin to use the tools that they're using to capture their stories and their history. So I think temporarily it is a solution. It may be a daunting task, but I think it's one worthwhile if we want to fill that gap of student life on our campuses. I represent HBCU as well. And so I know there's a gap in our collection about, I would even say starting back from 2010 to present, of student life and, you know, what did they do, what did they like, and things like that. And we always get those questions on our campuses. So I think it is a worthwhile temporary solution, but I think as optimists, we probably need to come up with a better solution.
I think that it is worthwhile if the content is worthwhile. So if all that we're getting are sort of reactions to like library programming, or if you know, you said it was hard to force it, and so if you're like forcing it, and it's a lot of work to figure out how you're going to capture it and preserve it, and it's not even accessible, you know, for a long time. I don't know that, I mean, it really comes down to the content. I think it'd be great if you were capturing Snapchat. Wait, I'm so not familiar with Snapchat, but I don't even know the lingo. But if you're capturing snaps of, you know, protests on campus and major events and things like that, then I think that it would be, it's worth it. But yeah, it comes down to the content.
And I think Tiffany originally, she saw the HBCU staff story and was like, this is great. This is student life on campus. This is their reactions to stuff, their everyday life. So originally she asked me, is there any way we can preserve, this is how it all started, is there any way we can preserve the HBCU staff story? Technically, literally I can, but I don't know, you know, but what does that mean? And maybe this is a discussion that we need to be having, like I said, I don't think we're coming up with a solution today, but like, if we keep discussing this and thinking about how we can maybe start documenting student life.
But so, if we do see a protest, is there a recourse for like reaching out to that user who created that and then asking them if we can keep it? And then maybe that would fuel some activists to know that that's a possibility.
And hoping that it will lead to better engagement with our students too. So then, you know, maybe we do have contacts in our student activist group. We have friends of the library Snapchat account that are doing this stuff. We can then reach out and contact them, building better relationships with our students in that way too, which maybe would lead to better student engagement with the archive.
The historical problem of ephemera is interesting because people didn't collect ephemera, or, you know, librarians didn't think about ephemera until, ephemera was ephemeral, and the amount of material and information is just, you know, technologically impossible to keep up with. So it just seems like you can have this desire to control all of that information, but the point to making decisions and curating, you've got to curate, or else
which is why we started with just the library's social media, just the library's Snapchat account too. It's overwhelming.
I'm trying to think through what I was going to say. It seems to me that everyone's raised deep concerns about sort of like chasing the technology, and it changes so much. But that they're still videos, like they're just little videos, right? Mm-hmm. So while you lose a lot of context, if you were to just like pull one of the videos out of the HBCU story and say, hey, we have this little video and it appeared in this context, and you have to sort of add that contextual information to it, but it would sort of, especially if you want to reach just out to a specific student, you would remove that ethical concern if they sort of agree to this and you sort of are clear about what you're preserving and preserve this little story. It's just a little video. It's removed from the platform and the way that people are going to, the way people experienced it at the time, but you could still provide, like, this was in a thing called Snapchat. Snapchat had this, you know, blah, 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 like all these other contextual pieces about Snapchat and how it operated. So it seems to me that, like, potentially, like, the archive is always like a heavily mediated thing anyway, right? Like, only certain things get into the archive, like, that's always been true. And so maybe if we think about, like, what's being produced out of these platforms, as opposed to, like, the platforms themselves. And then building our own context and our own interpretation of it. Of course, that's like, you know, we don't want to inject bias in that, and we're always trying to sort of massage that issue, but potentially that's like more surroundful at that point.
So I think this idea of using Snapchat is really interesting. I do have concerns about this idea of curating, though, because I do think that even what you all have already been saying about like what the library wants to represent its page, I just think about respectability politics and how that is going to play into this and the story that the library or these universities want to create about their student populations. That's not going to be helpful if someone comes back in 100 years and is trying to look at student life, because it's not really an accurate depiction of what that student life is. If students are actually you know, self-promoting or doing whatever, that is what students are doing at that moment in 2017 or 2018, and I think that that is sort of worth preserving as well.
There might be a way around that where we can watch in real time and take out stuff that's offensive but still save it, and then also maybe reach out. So it's like, yeah, there's some things we could do.
I also want to make sure, and I wasn't sure if I mentioned this earlier, was that the HBCU Snap story was just one of many. Any institution, so we are in Atlanta, and so you have Georgia Tech, Georgia State. If you go on their campuses, Georgia Tech had a story about Georgia Tech for Georgia Tech students, and vice versa. So it wasn't just HBCU, even if you go into finals, Snapchat would do one with finals for all college, so if you were in any geographic location that was a university, seeing how students, it was a lot of like the 83 words that you would see, but it would be across different institutions and universities. So even thinking about just kind of collecting those, and that is where the big ethical concerns come into, while no one institution is curating it, this app, but putting it in the context that this app is curating it, is still this great information that students are generating themselves and putting it on this app to be seen by the world. The sad part is, after this update, none of those exist anymore. They kind of went away from all of these stories. So in a matter of one school year, from the fall of 2017 to 2018, all of this information, even the ability to do it, is gone now. So just thinking, again, like Sarah said, creatively, about how to maybe, I guess, like you said, chase the technological comings of students to see how to possibly keep this information in some form or fashion. Because right now, based on our Snap, we hated it, but when we first did this presentation in November, we were all excited, and then by January, it was like, oh, it's almost pointless at this point. But again, it gave us great discussion to talk about amongst the profession, and think that we need to think about going forward, specifically as it deals with students in the archive.
Yeah, are there any questions or final thoughts? All right,
thank you guys.
You're not doing a
takeaway?
We have a list of takeaways.
Justin remembered. So these are just some very basic things, and we've kind of covered them,
I think, in our discussion too, but it's the idea of student-generated content requires curation, and as Gabby mentioned, that may or may not be something that, when we use the word curation, that may be something that you want to think about. Like, what are you curating? What are you doing it for your library? Are we still saving things and not displaying them? You know, all of that requires some thought, and I think that's a decision point that needs to be made. Staff-generated content versus student-generated content. So the staff, the library staff, can create content all day, and I'm not saying that that's not worth preserving, because it's the library, and as an institutional record, should be preserved as well. But for this particular project, we really wanted that student-generated content, and that we know in order to get that student-generated content, we have to meet them where they are. And whether that's either finding a way to get some of those HBCU Snap Story videos off of that Snap Story, contacting them and actually preserving it from there, or trying to do it with the library's account. And then realizing that if you do use a library's account, there will be questions that you have to think about and consider. Access to student-generated content needs to be limited, and I'm talking about putting those videos just online widely at this point. There's a lot of privacy concerns with that, so my thought as how we're doing a lot of our born digital content too would be it'd be accessible in the reading room only, and that once again is an institutional decision that would have to be made. Preservation does take staff time. So all of these things that we've just mentioned, whether we're pulling off a video, contacting a student, manually adding metadata, saving the snaps every day, all of that takes staff time. And so that's when my final question was, like, is this worth doing with the idea that you will need buy-in from your institution and your supervisor and all of that, making sure that you have the time and things that you need to get it done. Snapchat is a unique platform for unfiltered content right now. I'm sure it will not be the only one, so keep your ears around with that technology watch. And then hopefully we're marketing library services in a fun way, and we're trying to do something, we're trying to connect with our students with something that they're already using, which is why we chose Snapchat, even though I don't think anyone had Snapchat besides maybe Tiffany. we learned it and we became familiar with it in order to connect with our students and to market in that way. So I think even though, like Tiffany said, even if it's not Snapchat next year, there will be something, and we sort of need to keep our eye out for that so that we can, you know, stay relevant with our students too. All right, now that really is it. So are there any questions or any final thoughts?